2 years ago, some of my closest friends conspired on a conference pretty similar to this one, except they attended a conservative, evangelical, liberal arts school, which is a pretty humorous sequencing of words. A few professors attended, and administration refused to host it on campus. The two keynotes were Peter Rollins, an Irish continental philosopher influenced by the odd coupling of John Caputo and Slavoj Žižek, and Chris Hall, a Catholic potter and carpenter influenced by another odd couple, G.K. Chesterton and John Howard Yoder. I was a fan of both Pete and Chris, but I was living and working in Palestine at the time and was therefore unable to attend. But I did Skype with Chris, and that virtual discussion sparked an ongoing email conversation that through the concreteness of meals and back porch discussions and neighborhood walks have become what I would like to think is a genuine deepening friendship. Chris and I have frequent and long-winded arguments, which are one of the things I like about him. He thinks life's too short to beat around the bush. But he takes seriously, or tries to, Jed Meyer's definition of conversation as the open possibility of mutual conversion. He's currently finishing an account of his wild meanderings from the mall-like complex of Willow Creek to an old stone parish in the sacred heart of Camden, New Jersey. I've now read the pre-published book with endorsements from William Cavanaugh, James Allison, Richard Rohr, and Phyllis Tickle several times with praise and disdain. And even though we consistently quibble over issues like anarchism and ecclesiology, there's not much abstract about what he does as a worker theologian dedicated to the life and health of a city that's dying like an apocalyptic ruin. We won't say places we don't love, and we can't love places we don't know, and we can't know places with which we aren't intimately familiar. Chris knows that proximity matters. Where we live, who we live there with, and how we live define our relationship to the world. He jokes, but only slightly, that his carpentry and home repair craft is a liturgical effort to repent of his privilege as a white middle-class male. He and his parish mark the stations of the cross each Easter at locations in the neighborhood where people have been murdered in the last year. They always have more than 12. He's a reconfirmed Catholic with Anabaptist sensibilities who is re-inhabiting the margins of the belly of the beast. Several weeks ago, Chris was editing this evolving manuscript and realized how much Stanley Hauerwas had trained his epistemology and therefore his ecclesiology. So Chris Googled Hauerwas, found his office phone number, and picked up the phone. "Hello," said a voice. "Is Dr. Hauerwas there? This is Stanley." Chris explained who he was. "Oh yeah, I read Jesus for President. It's a good book." "Well," Chris said, surprisingly affirmed, "I'll just cut right to the chase. I read your stuff and I wonder, why aren't you Catholic?" Hauerwas laughed and for once stumbled over his words. "Well, probably, I don't know."
Hey guys, thanks so much for having me here. It is a privilege to be offered this spot to share, especially given such time right in front of Peter Duela responding to me. I heard Peter 6 years ago, and I thought, that guy is so sharp. I hope 6 years from now when I'm offered to talk, he is not my respondent. So let's get to this. I have a lot of material. I normally speak off the cuff like Matt Foley, motivational speaker, and I instead am going to just humorlessly go from the text. Is that okay? So I'm particularly mindful of the fact that I'm here as a Catholic in an Anabaptist gathering. I assume I'm partly here because I wrote a Yoderian tone book, Jesus for President. There I sang and still sing numerous hymns in praise of Anabaptists and their socio-political structure. While I wrote my book a few years ago into my Catholic journey, it was right around the time that I accelerated my Catholic studies and contemplation. And it has been the case that about every minute since the ink dried on that book, I've become more Catholic in orientation. What becoming Catholic means needs its own unpacking, but I will only now share in so much as my increasingly Catholic thoughts pertain to this Occupy movement and the way that you Anabaptist folks have themed this conference. So I'd like to frame up my remarks via a quote from my patron literary Saint Chesterton, an old fart Catholic if there ever was one. I'll quote from him a few times here as I've been reading from him a lot recently. And he says this, writing in his book, Utopia of Usurers. I should not say to Mr. Rockefeller, I am a rebel. I should say to him, I am a respectable man, and you are not. This declaration, seemingly aimed at the hip, restless, and protesty anarchists of his day, is a strong correction to what sometimes passes as protest orthodoxy. And we might say for Protestantism, but I digress. An essential problem of the self-proclaimed rebel's protest orthodoxy, that they are a rebel, is that he or she seems to be happy to be protesting. I do not say that one cannot be uproariously festive while protesting, but I do say that there is something twisted about being festive that we are protesting. To do so would be to protest as a sort of normal mindset, a new haughty subculture, proud to have avoided wearing clothing that might pass for manager apparel or bourgeois accessories. It has bucked the status quo in favor of some subversive organizing, or if you are a Christian, perhaps the work of the kingdom or the kingdom. Such Christians might theologize that Christ unsettled or Christ rocked the world. While this certainly has a ring of truth to it, I suggest that the opposite might be just as true, or I'd rather conjecture more true. It would do our entire mental structure, our social fabric, and our future a great favor to insist that Mr. Rockefeller does not represent some norm or status quo against which we are rebelling. Rather, the usurer is an affront against a public, historic, and social norm. Rockefeller, and oftentimes our sinful selves, ought not be granted the privilege of normalcy against which we rebel. That would be to forget that there is a massive difference between the words normal, implying a norm, and the word average, which describes what most people do. We know well from Jesus' gate metaphor that the average person does not pass through the proper norm or standard of God. By getting these words right, we see that it is the Rockefellers and Caesars of the empires that are, in fact, rocking the world, and it is the Christ tradition that might be better seen as attempting to stabilize the world. So within this rebel theology, I found a vague resentment of power, without often, of course, defining the word means can do, a resentment I'm slowly coming to find unsettling for my mind. Learning from the thought of René Girard, I've come to feel that some of this protest orthodoxy can mutate what was once a healthy sympathy towards the victims of power into a new rallying cry of antagonism, of a hatred so subtle and deep that it cannot be removed, for it has no particular aim, norm, or goal to judge by. Sometimes this mindset seems to relish in the mere thought of a crash with the riot police, almost more than the goal of getting things done. That is, declaring, I am a rebel, instead of declaring, I am a respectable woman and you are not. I'm all for the meaning of occupy to imply living into the world, blessing the city, as our song went, as opposed to vacating the world through vacation, but more on that later. But I take issue with the choice offered in the conference brochure between being either oppressive or disruptive, as if those are the only two paths. I have no inherent problem with disrupting the world, but I would only hope to do so to stabilize it. If by occupy we too greatly alienate ourselves from the world, this is where I want to begin expressing caution. So this brings me to my first point about the meaningfulness of Catholicity in a world that needs and is gifted by something like the Occupy movement. And that is the Catholic and other denominational habit of disciplining, excommunicating, or publicly pressuring usurers in defense of a public, historical, and civic norm. The Occupy movement, seen on its good days, dwells within that sanity. As I read the history of the co-development of Protestantism and capitalism, it was virtually every theologian and many pagan theologians, if you want to call them that, up to Calvin, who denounced usury as a sin worthy of ecclesial discipline. Now, in our day, virtually every Christian is only capable of denouncing ecclesial discipline. Aquinas was quite harsh on the matter, and Luther, God bless him, was quite harsh on the matter as well. But the world was drastically and rapidly changing in the time between Luther and Calvin. And whereas the former theologian had to criticize this increasingly commercial globalization, it was only 30 years later that Calvin just took it for granted. Calvin no doubt had his criticisms, but he appears to have left the door open for that slippery slope of that thing known as usury. It's hard to pin down exactly what that word means historically, but for our present purposes, we might just call that economics without morality. So this first point might be extended into our common logic by insisting that the phrase we so often hear, business is business, claiming that it's just normal to take your pound of flesh from your neighbor is a heresy. And the Occupy movement is going around declaring that that is a heresy. It is usually the words of someone who is about to sin. To play the, well, business is business card is plainly to hold up a hand of rejection to any claims other than money, like the preferential option for the poor, for justice, for morality, for rest, for beauty, all that stuff. Laissez-faire sounds a lot like anarchy to medieval Catholic theorists, granting free rein to our greedy impulses to exploit the poor. And so for these reasons, I'm delighted for the Occupy movement's tone and goals. So my first point might imply to my listener the second thing that I find in tension between Anabaptists and Catholics. And that is the notion that you heard me say before of a public historical civic norm for which the Christian might rally. Any person who has marinated in some Yoder or Hauerwas-themed politics might find a cognitive dissonance arise whenever the words defending a public historical civic norm wade into our ears. It's such a sound, we suddenly feel the need to stop, turn over our shoe, and check whether we just stepped into a hot, steamy pile of Constantinianism. The suspicion that having public politics might too easily turn into collusion with the empire is a fair suspicion. But something about it speaks of too harsh and unreflective separation with the world, something of an incessant fear that one will be caught participating or near the wrong crowd. I sometimes wonder if this antagonism renders us temporarily blind from seeing our real goals. For example, I have a Christian anarchist friend who tirelessly pits himself against the man and his minions, the police. I too share an aggressive distrust for the mere holding of these positions of power, knowing how such positions are prone to vast corruption. And I can barely trust a word out of any politician's mouth. But another Chesterton quote comes to mind here. It is rational to attack the police. Nay, it is glorious. But the modern critics of authority are like people who attack the police without ever having heard of burglary. My anarchist friend seems to feel that he has overcome this corruption of the empire's policemen by hearkening back to some more organic pattern of the old tribal sharif, some clan version of sacred community policing or something. I get the feeling that if I were to say the word indigenous into his, in his presence, he would sway gently and coo like a rocked baby. While he knows that the modern word sheriff comes from that word, he does not seem to have ever sat down under a tree to look across the street, squint his eyes, and imagine the police officer walking by as if he or she were wearing a feathered headdress. Let me bring about the point even closer to home. I moved into a very dilapidated and violent neighborhood about 9 years ago. At the time, I moved in with Christian anarchism as the foremost of all my other philosophies. Lots of Yoderianism mixed with, thank God I'm not part of the empire. Thank God I've moved out of the abandoned places, into the abandoned places of empire to occupy it as a rebel. That was my shtick. I distrusted the police even more than I distrusted the street people they might be found arresting. Again, for really good sociological reasons. But as I continued living there, I found myself very uncomfortably getting involved in some neighborhood meetings, and all of a sudden, some police showed up to them. Some were even invited by community members. These supposed representatives of empire. So at first I had an allergic reaction, but then I had to consider whether participating with them, even in a limited fashion, was worthy or unworthy of Christian discipleship. I cannot say that it is an easy shift at all, but something about continuing to meet with them and even guide them and even give them input as a community representative has been a very humanizing experience for me. I have come to find that we have a common goal, and though we differ significantly on the ways to get there, I can at least connect with them as fellow humans and Camdenites and not see them as devils. And sometimes I just have to squint and pretend that they have a Sharif's headdress on. So I've connected my police experiences with my Anabaptist political leanings by calling to mind Yoder's Christian witness to the state and his desire for any Christian political involvement to be very precise, the change of this or that policy, and not just some general vague protest. To my knowledge, Yoder's witness was received as a move towards a more like Catholic worldly participation and was far too worldly for some of his hardcore Anabaptist readers. At least that's what I hear. But tackling a few particulars does not satisfy the rebel radical's mind, as it wants everything overturned, all or nothing, in which case the rebel may often get nothing. I continue to move away from this all or nothing mindset as it cedes the status quo to the Rockefellers and only insists upon the anarchist beatific vision. Within the Occupy movement itself, I am delighted to have heard of there arising some very precise demands, the foremost of which is the demolition of corporate personhood. I couldn't agree more, and I'm endlessly thankful for their efforts. I think they're serving us all. So with my first 2 points being a caution against the rebel mindset, the mind that only views the world through either oppression or disruption, the mind that is too pure to sometimes participate in the world, I turn to a third point about perceiving Catholicity. So just as I wonder whether my anarchist friend would sometimes actually recognize a modern Sharif, even if it were right in front of him, I sometimes wonder whether many of us who fall into the rebel protest mindset would recognize Catholicity, even if it were before our eyes. While moving into Camden as a zealous Protestant evangelical, I held the common enough position that what the Catholic Church calls Catholicity is, in fact, empire. I indulged in that prima facie assumption that anything so baggage-laden, global, and powerful must, of course, be of the devil, an exact opposite of the hierarchy-busting Jesus, right? So I've been challenged to see things otherwise. First, Jed Myers helped point out to me the different ways of viewing power and empire via the Tower of Babel and Pentecost stories. You may have read this essay. It's a popular one. Myers points out that the two stories symbolize ways of organizing culture and language. Babel is a story of centripetality, of power merely at the center into which all things pour. This is colonization. It's what Brueggemann mentioned. And this, for myself, is a good way of describing empire. Pentecost, on the other hand, is a story of centrifugality, of spreading out and deconstructing power, elevating diversity and the, you know, numerous tongues. Here, like Babel, we are still given a story of understanding language, but also a story of hearing people from their unique origins, creating a new kind of connection based not on congealing of economic and political power, but of experiencing the disarming and reconciling gospel together. This might be best understood as the call of the church. So this all harmonizes with what I've come to see and experience in the Anabaptist diaspora, whether in the distant dirt roads of backwoods Belize, where one can find Mennonites carving a home out of the jungle, or in the mountains of New York among the Bruderhof, many other Mennonites that I've met. But for me, a second author, William Kavanaugh, added to these ideas a sense of Catholic universality, something more connected and globalized than the merely diasporic vision. For this, Kavanaugh looks to the ritual of Eucharist. In his essay, The World in a Wafer, the Eucharist as a practice of resisting globalization, he encourages Christians to see how the Eucharist, unlike globalization, quote, produces a Catholicity which does not simply separate us from the local, but contains the whole universal Catholica within each local embodiment of the body of Christ. End quote. I found something very beautiful in this, something I think it will take a lifetime to see from all of its mysterious angles. I think I experience this point in part when I sit across our Eucharistic table from the Okwamba family at our church, Nigerian immigrants, or Vietnamese immigrants for with whom we can exchange no language at all at morning mass, and we share in the ritual together. There we share a center that has become known around the world, and we are both able to come to the Eucharistic table with a shared referent. And the shared referent, Kavanaugh goes on saying that the Eucharist implants us into a story, a shared history, a direction, a gift that much of our lost world lacks. Quote, "The consumer of the Eucharist is no longer the schizophrenic subject of global capitalism, awash in a sea of unrelated present moments, but they walk into a story with a past, present, and a future," end quote. In a way that even the most liberally minded in the world could barely imagine, this Eucharistic story calls the whole world, the Gentiles, the majority, to identify themselves with the story of a minority, the Jews, and particularly join in the story of its crucified Lord. It is tearing down the mountains to fill in the valleys, mountaintop removal being a bad image that I don't think John the Baptist had in mind. What a vision of Catholicity, that is where we all come together in listening to and participating in that humbling and elevating and connecting story. And I cannot help myself but to continue quoting him. "We might add that it is precisely God's transcendence of the world that allows liturgical difference. For where God cannot be fully grasped, a diversity of locations and practices is necessary to imply the transcendent. Nevertheless, liturgical difference is possible not because all particular signs are interchangeable. On the contrary, in the Eucharist, the particular is of the utmost importance. For this particular piece of bread, at this particular place and time, is the body of Christ, and it is not merely a pointer to an abstract transcendent standing behind the sign. In the Eucharist, there is a hypostatic union between reality and sign," end quote. I feel like I can get away with using the words hypostatic in a seminary kind of environment. To reconnect this beautiful idea with my police example, I guess I would have to say that the Eucharist has made me feel more at home in the world, maybe, even as I've been told to feel a sense of resident alienation from Hauerwas and others. On paper, one might say that the real presence in the Eucharist has made me feel more at ease in my present corner of this ruined world. One might say that the real presence makes me feel less and less alienation and distance from the secular parts of the world, not just its bread and wine, of course, but its police officers, its liquor stores, its prostitutes, and crappy neighborhood meetings. It allows me to feel that the immediate problems I face there are my opportunity to engage with the cosmological struggle for resurrection. I ought not therefore see my essential source of sacredness as only in the future, or in a different place to which I must vacate, or even in some kind of invisible church, you know, some big cloudy idea. It's right here. Kavanaugh writes, "In an economy of hypermobility, we resist not by fleeing, but by abiding. This is the sense that I heartily support, a Christian sense of occupying the world." So, I started on the 7, so I have 5 more minutes. All right, got to hustle here. So besides opening me up to this sense of sacralizing the profane, I might also say that the Catholic vision of universality enacted in the Eucharist has offered me a way of perceiving global Catholic connection with others via my engagement in a local particular church. This, however, far from being a harbinger of comfort, ought to discomfort us in a good way. For it is a very dangerous thing to be part of a real physical body in which, if one part suffers, all parts ought to feel their suffering. If we do not discern the body in this way, it may lead to a schizophrenia even worse than the one created by global capitalism. What are the psychological implications of saying that one is part of a billion-member body, physically connected through the physical sacraments, especially with many of these members being poor or perhaps economically exploited by folks like myself? But another element of the Catholic Church has given me a model for imagining the global local connection. To this end, I would like to bore you with a quote about ecclesiology, which will go over like a lead balloon. "The universal church and the individual church are mutually exclusive. They dwell within one another mutually. That is why it is part of the essential structure of the church to have two focuses, like the two focuses of an ellipse. It is both papal and episcopal, or one might say globally connected and locally embodied. Neither of the two poles can be traced back to the other. This unity in tension is the foundation of the union in communion. The communion, which is both locally episcopal and papal, global, is the essential organic expression of the essential structure of the Church, its unity in Catholicity, and its Catholicity in unity. So I imagine that's making a few Anabaptists uncomfortable here, and I understand that. But in opening up this topic of the global Church in discussion of empire, I'm broaching something that has been very uncomfortable to me as well. For Anabaptists, I sympathize with this reservation, the sense that Catholic-sounding things lead to more persecution. But an essential question I've had to ask is whether all our attempts at reconstructing church are categorically better than the ones handed down to us by patriarchs and matriarchs, even ones from the pre-Constantinian era, not just from this so-called corrupt Constantinian era that we're coming out of. For it is a very difficult thing. How do we make something that is globally connected without it being empire? How can we develop Christ's body in such a way that it can connect the local with the global? How would you do it that so that it wouldn't be worse than the current one? So while the Catholic universality does not seem right to many, the difficulty is whether we can find something obviously and categorically better. One example that has made a few of my Mennonite friends blush is they're retelling me the story of the development of some of their own schisms. And particularly a most curious one, the development of the non-conference conference. Have any of you heard of that? Of Mennonites? This group, on par with the non-denominationalists of my background, presume that the best way forward in this world, the best way towards a more open-minded and broad Catholicity, is to buck all of the corrupt traditions and structures and then start a new one, which will presumably militate against any staleness or corruption. This militancy thus becomes their new unnerving tradition. To all of this, I have come to the conclusion that no one is exempt from corruption, not even Mennonites. We cannot say to ourselves, if I had lived in the days of the Crusades or Inquisitions, I would not have killed the prophets. Or if I had been handed the keys to the kingdom, I would not have turned it into a hierarchy of religious structure. To me, all of this is nonsense. Its logical end is thousands of denominations and one-person churches. It's also immoral blaming of scapegoating of ancestors. Another Chesterton quote comes to mind. The Jacobin French revolutionist could tell you not only the system he would rebel against, but what was more important, the system that he would not rebel against, the system he would trust. But the new rebel is a skeptic, and he will not entirely trust anything. He has no loyalty. Therefore, this rebel can never really be a revolutionist. And the fact that he doubts everything really gets in his way when he wants to denounce anything. For all denunciation implies a moral doctrine of some kind. And the modern revolutionist doubts not only the institution he denounces, but the doctrine by which he or she denounces it. End quote. So to me, the non-denominationalist, as well as the non-conference conference folks, suffer from this difficulty. So while lambasting the, quote, imperial church, they nevertheless cannot escape starting their own new, corruptible, structured church. Even Yoder, especially in his early days, suffered from this disorientation toward and categorical separation from tradition in his Concern Movement pamphlets, detailed in the Menno-Catholic Gerald Schlabach's Unlearning Protestantism, who I understand is not exactly given feast days and laurels of flowers here. With time prohibiting much more depth, I should summarize and close. In all, I'm attempting to say that I'm uncomfortable with merely claiming to be a rebel or a Protestant. I've had enough resident alienation in the world. If one is going to remain a rebel, I would suggest one should have a very specific set of demands for when such alienation would end. Like, I will stop occupying the front of your building when you do X. Or I will reunite with the denomination from which mine split or which split from me when we finally come to an agreement on Y. It may be advisable to think about what to do if one doesn't get those demands. But as stated, it has been suggested to me by my patron literary saint to be much more cautious about using rebel language. Last paragraph here. I've also attempted to share just some basic thoughts on resisting a false association between Catholicity and empire. That there, I think, is a difference between Babel and a global church, even the one Luther accused of living in Babylonian captivity. I'm trying to imagine that it might be possible to attempt a global movement to unite and reconcile people, even if it requires constant ecclesial correction and upkeep from becoming stale, corrupt, and oppressive. This, after all, is what non-conference conferencers have to do anyway. And I know it does not suit many, but I've thrown in my hat with the Catholic attempt at such a movement of global Catholicity. And in this Catholic body, in its Eucharistic interplay between the local and the global, I've seen some pattern that connects one not merely with the church, but with the world, with its bread, its wine, its cities, and even its police officers. From this stable grounding in history and tradition, I feel more capable of saying with the occupiers to the Rockefellers, I am a respectable man and you are not. Otherwise, I do not want to live in the lonely, false humility, even the false pride of, I am a rebel. That will be all.
Okay, thank you very much. It's very nice to be here with you. Thanks, Brian, Aaron. And I'm delighted to be a respondent to Chris. Maybe I should start with a sort of an apology. Back in January or December, Chris emailed me and asked me to read his book. And this was before school started. I said, yeah, I'd love to read your book. And then school started, and I never read his book. And I'm going to need this.
Yeah.
Strangely enough, a couple years ago, Gerald Schlaubach, who Chris mentioned, also wrote a book about becoming Catholic. And this has become something of a genre, which is worth pointing out here. White male theologians approaching middle age become Catholic and then write books about it or start blogs. And it'd be worth thinking about, you know, I mean, this is becoming sociologically as interesting as theologically, but I'm not a sociologist, so we'll leave that aside. But Gerald asked me to read his book. I said, sure, I'd love to read your book. And I never did. Because there's just so many other things to read. You know, you can just keep rereading Isaac Villegas' sermons instead of reading anything new. And then I got an invitation to write something for MQR, which I wrote about Gerald's book in public. So I feel bad on both occasions that I don't do the private response, and then in public I end up... I'm sure it's also kind of interesting that I'm the one that gets asked to respond to these... I don't know, I'm not sure why you asked me, but anyhow, I'm glad to be here, and I'll start by saying that I'm in profound agreement with most of what Chris said. That's the bright side. Then on the other side, I should say that I'm not sure that profound agreement makes me any less Anabaptist or any more inclined to an account of transubstantiation. But we can get into why. I'll start by, I should check the time too. It's a blast of fresh air to have someone come to a gathering of Anabaptists and not just flatter us. There is a genre of theological writing commonly associated with Stanley Hauerwas, but picked up in recent years by people like Greg Boyd and Brian McLaren, and David Fitch was here a few weeks ago. That gushes in praise for all things Anabaptist, especially naked Anabaptist. And some of you know that book. I imagine this is very helpful to the churches they pastor, but isn't very helpful for Anabaptists. In some sense, it's very harmful, just insofar as it reinforces the narcissistic narrowness of a lot of contemporary Mennonite theology. Reinforces a tendency to view the world of theology as, on one hand, the good pacifist Anabaptist, then consign everything else to some huge amorphous dustbin called the mainstream or the classical. In this picture, the Anabaptists are the only folks, aside from the first three centuries of the church and Gandhi, who really believe in Jesus. My own tendency, deeply influenced by Arnold Snyder's historical work, has been to try to emphasize two things in both my teaching and my writing. First, the Anabaptists share an enormous amount of overlap with other Christian groups, and we should celebrate that, and in some cases cultivate it. And second, I try to emphasize to my students just how mobile, complex, contradictory, glorious, ugly, and varied the Christian tradition is, including the medieval tradition. The two claims go together. Together they say that it isn't that Anabaptists share a great deal with some monolithic capital T tradition, but that Anabaptism is very much a part of that incredibly diverse history, and we should find productive ways to interact with it, not just write it off as mainstream. To the extent Chris is helping us do that, I'm very pleased and happy. But part of the problem with this view of Anabaptism is that it can quickly turn on itself. That is, the Anabaptist versus the mainstream. And this is one way of stating my first worry with Chris's paper. A worry that Chris has retained the clumsy binary but just switched sides. As I guess this is partly because his account of Anabaptism wasn't very thick. But I think that Chris can become this kind of Catholic convert because he was that kind of Anabaptist convert, if that makes any sense. So apparently, Chris once thought, I have a copy of his paper here, but it says, I indulged in the prima facie assumption that anything so baggage-laden, global, and powerful, the Catholic Church, must of course be of the devil, an exact opposite of the hierarchy busting Jesus, or elsewhere. Catholic-looking things lead to more persecution. And then finally this, which was towards the end. I have come to the conclusion that no one is exempt from corruption, not even Mennonites. We cannot say to ourselves, if I had lived in the days of the Crusades or Inquisitions, I would not have killed the prophets. Or, if only I had been handed the keys to the kingdom, I would not have turned it into a religious structure. Do we say that? Do Anabaptists say that? Apparently we do. Or apparently we can give the impression that we do. Think those things. So to the degree... So maybe one way to say this would be that among the list of Chris's worries about Anabaptism here, we need to sort out, those of us who are Anabaptists, which things we need to repent of, which things are maybe exaggerations, like we think we're exempt from corruption, and which are things that are actually true and we need to stand by and stick to our guns on, to use a great pacifist metaphor. So, I mean, part of the message to those younger Anabaptists here is that the Manichaean view of Anabaptism, which seems to be of Anabaptism and Catholicism, which seems to be where Chris is coming from, isn't going to last very long if you spend even a thoughtful hour with Augustine's Confessions or with Papa Rotzi's Introduction to Christianity. That's what we cool kids call Pope Benedict, Papa Ratzinger. Or Balthazar's Theodrama. These are extraordinary texts. They'll blow your doors off. And if you come to them thinking that Catholicism is of the devil, then you're going to convert in a hurry. Okay. So to summarize, I guess it seems to me that this is as much an argument with your past as it is with those of us who call ourselves Anabaptists. And secondly, can I get the website now? I should also say something about Hauerwas here, since there's a lot of Hauerwas students here, and since I owe so much to the old man, and since the reaction to him in recent years is becoming pretty virulent, right? Either people becoming like sort of kind of radical Barthians on one side or Catholics on the other, but we don't have time for that. Most of you know or have spent time on this extraordinary document of our time, the We Are the 99% Tumblr. People have been posting pictures here for months. I don't know how many they are, hundreds, maybe thousands. They are asked to write on a piece of paper their story and then end it with, you can just scroll through a few times, Brian, I am the 99%. They tend to sound, have a lot of overlap. My name is Darlene. I have a high school diploma, college experience, and job skills. I'm trying to start a family of my own after leaving public housing, but I can't find a job. I am the 99%. Keep going, Brian. Yeah, there is a whole narrative there. I am still the 99%. I'm sure you've been to this website. We don't need to spend a lot here, but I want these images in your head just for a second. And now I'm going to get in their way. When Chris quoted that great quote from Chesterton, I should not say to Mr. Rockefeller, I'm a rebel. I should say, I'm a respectable man, and you are not. I thought we were about to hear a reflection on how radically that is instantiated by the Occupy slogan. Yeah, we are the 99%. And we did get a little bit of that. Chris said the Occupy movement, seen on its good days, dwells within this sanity. So I want to reflect just really briefly on this movement. And I'm not going to say anything here that I didn't rip off from the lead editorial in the latest N+1, which I recommend to you. First, We Are the 99% announces the Occupy movement as something historically unique in the history of American protest. Heretofore, the great historical struggles in the U.S. have been to include some particular disenfranchised group in the we the people. Whether it's women's suffrage or the end of Jim Crow or gay marriage, such movements take a specific group and demand that it too be included in the people. Occupy is strikingly different in that it attempts, to quote from N+1, to redefine the American populace at large as an excluded group. Just how this has come to pass, or whether it's true, or what it could even mean, are questions worthy of this conference's consideration. Second, We Are the 99% is clearly false. It's probably more like 80-20, but such literalism misses the point. 40% of Americans, according to polls, believe they have a shot at joining the top tier. That's why they vote the way they do. That is, they easily imagine themselves moving upward. We Are the 99% is not a demographic claim. It's an invitation to imagine yourself downward, to identify with the jobless and uninsured, not as some kind of imaginative act of charity, but as a live possibility of our economy. Those of you who are graduating next year will find this easier than some others. Third, the slogan has not just been, we are the 99%. What's interesting about the Tumblr is the strange linguistic work, I am the 99%. What keeps I am the 99% from becoming an act of insufferable narcissism? It is at once a moment of identification and exclusion. I am the 99%, emphasis on the 99%, is a claim of solidarity with anyone on the downside of the recession. I am the 99%, also excludes the you who is not, or will not, identify. That is, it's not enough here to sympathize. Finally, I am the 99% enacts quite literally what Chris quoted Kavanaugh as calling a Catholicity, which is not simply preceding the local. Here, the universal and the particular are held together in a speech act. And it does so without the simple account of globalization Kavanaugh relies on. But to say that requires that we be willing to think about the sacralizing of the profane in precisely the ways that Chris is encouraging.